So it's not clear to me that I'm going to give the talk you're expecting to get. I do work on this on the cell cycle, and I can talk about that. But what I came prepared to do, and I guess I actually thought I told you guys that this is what I was going to do, is to give a much more general talk, and I'm going to be here till Friday. So it seemed like. And this talk may be insulting because it's going to assume that you know essentially nothing. This is basically the talk I gave to the math department at Harvard. And in that case, the assumption was valid. And so you've been here as part of a program in biology and physics. So I would really urge you, if you go like, oh my God, this is ridiculous, we know all this stuff, just tell me and we can go faster or we can do something different. I'm totally happy to talk off the cuff about the cell cycle. I guess later in the week I'm going to talk about signaling networks, and one of those involves the cell cycle, and people can certainly, if they want to pick my brains about the cell cycle informally, I don't have anything to do this week, so I'm at your disposal. Okay. So I guess I came here to learn too. To learn what biology and physics might be able to do together, and so the pitch, I'm going to try and explain historically how biology got to where it is now, which is a somewhat uneasy mixture of two different approaches, and also to explain something about how I think physics and biology are different, and whether there might be general principles in biology, and I'll sort of go through all that stuff. And I would like to treat this as informal as possible, as informally as possible. So if you have questions, you should stop me and ask me. And in particular, if I say anything that either seems unclear or wrong to you, you should stop me too, because the chances are if it's unclear to you, it will be unclear to someone else as well. Okay. So this is an outline of the talk. And I'm going to start by making the point, which presumably, it's sort of inherent already, is that biology is really about information processing and transfer. That it's in transition between one mode of analysis, which is the one that was practiced for most of the 20th century, particularly the second half of the 20th century, and another mode, which is based on the sequences of whole genomes and trying to collect comprehensive systematic data for everything that's happening in cells all at the same time. To introduce you to, biology does have a central question. Perhaps it's an impossibly broad one, which is how do biological systems survive, evolve, and reproduce? And that question occurs at multiple levels. It occurs at the levels of proteins, and a lot of you said that you're interested in protein folding, which is something I'll come back to towards the end. It occurs at the level of cells, organs, organisms, and populations. And I think one of the really important questions, as well as are there any general principles, is in particular, are there general principles that work across all these scales? And I will argue that there is at least one. And I think part of the excitement now is it's sort of a little different from the Schrodinger inspired stuff where physicists came into biology in the hope that they would discover new physical laws that would be required to explain why biology does such weird and funky things. I guess it's an interesting question. Do any of you in this room believe that that will be true? Okay, I guess not. My first graduate student, although she now denies this, she and I have a bet because she believed that's why she'd gone into biology. She didn't come from physics, but she just believed that would be true. However, although no one appears to think that there will be new physical laws, one of the questions is if there are general principles, are there principles that work across multiple scales and really contribute to our understanding biology? And I guess the last and most important part is the reason I'm here is this is a plea for help. Biology is in a period where we need much more help than we previously did because we have much more data to analyze than we previously did and hopefully it is some of the same sorts of data that physicists and applied mathematicians have cut their teeth on analyzing. I hear that we have early signs of protest. If my daughter were here, she would not be being nearly as quiet. So this is sort of how I see biology working, and where it says computational biology here, it could say physicists too. I mean, just depends on. So biology, I mean, the traditional way. One of the other things I should explain is that biologists lie about what they do. I don't know whether physicists lie as well, but there's this thing about the scientific method. So the idea is, you collect data, you turn the data into information, and this then suggests hypotheses, which are tested. And when the hypotheses are not disproved, they enter into something called knowledge. Knowledge informs more experiments, and you go around this loop. Actually, what tends to be true is that on the basis of incredibly fragmentary information, people dream up ideas for knowledge, and actually things are induced rather than deduced. And so you tend to start, there's a little something here, but there's some sort of leap of faith here. And then that informs the experiments that do things. And so in the, and new technology, and biology, I guess, theoretical physics presumably is not, like, the tests of it are limited by technology. The thinking part presumably is not limited by technology in the same way that biology is. And so technology plays an important role because it determines what data you can collect and what experiments you can do. And I guess, oh, well, here's the, this is really where lots of the biology actually starts. And the one thing that biologists are possibly very good at doing, I mean, one of the things that's always a little terrifying about biologists talking to physicists is the assumption is that the physicists are enormously smarter than we are. And so biologists have to find something to believe they're good at doing. And I think the one thing that biologists may be quite good at doing is marshaling very large amounts of seemingly disparate facts and creating moments of intuition that lead to ideas that explain how things work. And the thing that's changing is that over here there are vast amounts of data now being generated in a way that wasn't true before. In the past, I'm going to argue that biology was a data-limited science. And there is a real question as to whether things that biologists are conventionally trained to do are going to be very good at transforming this data into information and then into knowledge. And so those, I hear that Joe DeRisi talked here recently, not recently, 2 weeks ago. So some of you will have heard him. So I should explain what I mean by some of these things. So an example of data is the data from microarray experiments. Information from that, it has to do with, for example, clustering genes that have similar patterns of expression. Knowledge would be if we could use that information to infer things about pathway and structure and function, and even more importantly about general principles, but even inferring something about pathway structure and function from clustering is a good start. So here's a reminder of the molecules of which life is composed. So I'm sure you all know all this, but the point I would make is that the structure and function of DNA can easily be predicted from its sequence. I mean, this is the seminal contribution that Watson and Crick made. And it, in a certain sense, it's not very complicated after that. RNA, there are parts of RNA molecules, particularly the ones that have catalytic functions like ribosomal RNA and self-splicing introns, where there are elaborate three-dimensional structures, and these two depend on the fundamental Watson-Crick rules. And this, you know, if you like, this is a general principle in biology, A pairs with T, G pairs with C. And the point that I'd like to make, and again, I'll come back to this later, is that this is not true for proteins. There is no general rule for how you predict the parts of a protein that touch each other from its primary sequence. Okay, and obviously several of you are interested in this question. The other reason why it's important to mention this vis-a-vis genomics is the fact that there is this code, and that DNA and RNA share the code means that you can make reagents to monitor the level of nucleic acids in a simple way, because you can use the principle of sequence complementarity to make those reagents. So all you need is the sequence of a genome to make all the reagents you want to detect nucleic acids and levels of nucleic acids. The same is spectacularly not true of proteins. And one of the points that I want to make is that proteins are the principal actors inside cells. And so using, for example, the levels of RNA inside cells as surrogate markers for the levels of proteins inside cells is actually a fairly dangerous thing to do. And I'll give you an example of that. So here's our friend the central dogma, which just illustrates this point about it being about RNA processing. DNA goes into DNA, DNA goes into RNA, RNA goes into protein. Crick wasn't quite right. A little bit of information can trickle back this way. And although in the modern day world, that trickle is relatively insignificant unless you're interested in certain viral diseases, it's argued plausibly, but unfortunately not provably, that this trickle at one point was very important because life started out with just RNA and without there being any DNA around. And inventing this made it possible to carry information in a much more stable way than it can be carried in RNA. So in a sense, this is absolutely correct representation of what life is. In another, it's dramatically misleading. And what I should have done is brought with me a test tube of DNA. Okay? And so we could take that test tube of DNA and we could tape it to the chalkboard there, and you could come back this afternoon, it would look exactly the same, and that would be true tomorrow. And you could keep doing that as long as the building kept standing, and all you would see is a very slow chemical decay of DNA, which is chemically a very tough molecule. And that wouldn't come close to resembling life. And so the point that I want to make is that it's actually the proteins in the modern, the argument is that there was once an RNA world where RNA molecules did these things, but it's now, we clearly live in a protein world, and proteins convert energy, control the environment, make the building blocks that cells need to reproduce themselves, so they're responsible for cell growth, cell proliferation, for regulating what happens inside cells, and for communicating both within cells and between different parts of cells, and ultimately between organisms. Okay. And the key thing to remember, and again, in a sense this is stating the obvious, but I think it's worth reminding you of that as forcibly as possible, is that not all the DNA makes it into messenger RNA. And the rate at which individual messenger RNA molecules are translated to make proteins varies widely between different messenger RNA molecules inside the cell. And in an organism with a single cell, which DNA molecules make it into RNA varies depending on the circumstances of the cell. And in a multicellular organism, it varies from cell to cell. So that this is actually a very complicated feedback system where which proteins are present determine how effectively RNA molecules are translated into proteins. So the little green arrows means that they're proteins that stimulate the translation of particular messenger RNAs. The little red bars mean there are other proteins that inhibit their translation. The same is true in the sense that there are specific proteins like the things that Potashny talked about, the lambda repressor, which for example blocks the transcription of all the genes in bacteriophage lambda except one, its own gene, whose transcription it weakly stimulates. And in cells, be they prokaryotic or eukaryotic, there are on average tens to usually hundreds, and in ourselves thousands of such proteins which are controlling which DNA molecules get copied into RNA. And the point, the reason for showing you this is there's a very strong history dependence to the system, because which proteins you're going to make depends on which proteins you started out with, and it's important to bear all this in mind. The little blue lines down here mean that RNA molecules are also responsible for controlling some of these things, but they're less important than protein molecules. And I guess the point I want to make about how much it's a protein world is that one of the experimental systems that people who work with me work on are the early cell division cycles of fertilized frog eggs. So if you take a frog egg and you fertilize it, which you can do outside frogs and under experimental control, those eggs will go through 12 very rapid cell cycles to produce about 4,000 cells. That process occurs without any significant new transcription. So, and it will occur even if you block transcription by using inhibitors of RNA polymerase. So here's something very elaborate that happens without any required changes in the levels of messenger RNA. So that if you looked at all that by doing transcript array experiments, you would argue, well, shit, there's nothing interesting happening in this system because there aren't any genes going up and down. But what's happening is that proteins are doing things to other proteins. And the other thing, the other perhaps even more surprising thing, is there aren't very many proteins going up and down from experiments that I did when I was a postdoc. There's a single protein that has to be synthesized and destroyed in each one of those cell cycles. And other than that one protein, you can block the synthesis of new proteins. And yet the cells are undergoing these remarkably elaborate architectural transformations. And that's all occurring, with the single exception that I just mentioned, without changes in the levels of proteins. What's happening is changes in the localization and changes in the activity and changes in the covalent modification status of proteins. And those are things, for example, that we're not good yet at systematically monitoring.
I didn't understand. You start with a single cell and you get 4,000 cells.
Yes.
And in fact, you have a protein which has one copy in the third cell, you have one copy in the other cell. So that protein has been multiplied by 4,000 times.
So the cell is dividing without growing larger. So most cells, including the cells in an adult body, grow in size before they divide. Is the same as it was in the single cell which you started. So. Yeah, DNA is replicated, and so the egg is born with many, many molecules of DNA polymerase and many molecules of the messenger RNA that encodes the DNA polymerase and ribonucleotide reductase, which makes deoxyribonucleotide triphosphates. The egg's doing stuff, right? The important point that your question raises, it's not getting bigger, it's just being subdivided into smaller and smaller parts. But all of that is, I'm a missionary for the protein world. The point that I'm making, and I guess, since it seems surprising to you, it's worth emphasizing it, is there's no transcription required. There are very few proteins where you need fluctuations in their levels. This is by and large all happening because proteins modify each other's activities, right? And that this is the extreme end of the spectrum, right? That if we took one of the cells a cell out of your body, like a lymphocyte, which we can persuade to proliferate in culture, and we blocked the expression of new messenger RNAs and we tried to induce it to proliferate, it wouldn't do that because it has to increase in size and do all these things, and it does have to express new genes, and you can learn about pathways that control the cell division cycle by looking at those changes. But the point I'm trying to make from looking at the extreme situation is just by interactions amongst proteins and a very limited amount of synthesis and degradation of proteins, you can get something remarkably complicated like the cell division cycle to happen. Yes?
You know there's no mRNA activity because you have a block translation or you block
Right. If you block translation, you stop the cell division cycle. Okay? But you can, what happens in the experiment, let me just describe it logically. If you want, I can describe technically how it works. You block the translation. Actually, the way the experiment works so far is that this is actually technically accurate too. And it's done in an extract of eggs rather than the eggs themselves. But since those extracts will support all the key features of the cell division cycle, we argue that the conclusion would be exactly the same. What you do is you destroy all the messenger RNA. Okay? You then inactivate the scissors you use to cut up the messenger RNA. When you've done that, the cell cycle stops. You now add back the messenger RNA encoding only one protein, the protein called cyclin. You synthesize cyclin. The extract goes into mitosis. Cyclin is destroyed. The extract comes back in to interphase. You make more cyclin. It goes back into mitosis. And at least for one or two cell cycles, it is the only protein that you need to make more of. And then you both need to make more of it to get into mitosis. You need to destroy it to get out. Okay? And if you were just looking at the abundance of molecules, that is the only change you would see. If you're looking at the cell, you would see all these fantastic, wonderful things happening. But they're happening because proteins are modifying each other's activity, not their amount.
Within
1 or 2%, no. I mean, there could be some tiny effect, but yeah, I should have brought a movie of frog egg dividing because it would make it a lot clearer. I mean, what's happening is this is a frog egg, and I guess the other thing I should say that maybe will help make things less weird is it's a millimeter in diameter, but a typical cell in your body is more like 10 microns in diameter. And so what happens is, that's the first cell division, this is the second, and so on and so forth. You're just cutting one cell up into more and more cells. But all the key, a typical cell biologist would argue that's the interesting part of the cell cycle, all the stuff that this cell has to do where it gets bigger before it divides so that it can produce two daughters of the same size is growth, right? Biologists are also very bad about using terms. So there are two terms. There's growth and there's proliferation. And I take growth to mean an increase in mass and proliferation to mean an increase in number. And when biologists talk about cell growth, they have these two terms all mixed up. I mean, so do I sometimes too, but it can be very confusing.
What about the other one?
There are changes in local concentration that have to do with things that will happen later, right? But they're not required for the basic feed. I mean, within cells, there are changes of where proteins are in that cell that are absolutely critical for some of the events that go on. Okay, and there are also global changes in their concentration of proteins that are higher in some cells than they are in others. And those changes are ultimately going to induce changes in gene expression, which are going to mean that some of those 4,000 cells do different things developmentally from the others, which is the sort of thing that Eric Davidson was bending your ear about.
Are the divisions synchronized?
Yeah, they are. And one of the interesting questions, which is something that I used to worry about, I worry about other things instead now, is they're remarkably synchronous. So if you make movies of these eggs, they're actually metachronous, technically speaking. That is that the egg has a top and the bottom, it's asymmetric. And you see that division, especially as you get more and more cells, division starts at the top and it moves as a very uniform wavefront over the surface of the egg. And so one of the questions is, does that just mean that the clock that drives cell division has an extremely rigid periodicity so that everyone gets out of everyone stays in synchrony just because the precision of that clock is so high? Or is there some communication that enforces a synchrony? And in principle, there's a technically, it's harder than it sounds, but it's intellectually simple. You could just separate the cells, say at the 8-cell stage, and you can now ask, do the progeny of one of those 8 cells stay in synchrony, but do they tend to lose synchrony with the others? And that's actually, if someone wants, that's a very feasible experiment to do. But it's, so is the, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this. So, I mean, one of the things is the level of complexity is extraordinarily high. So a yeast cell has a volume of about 10 to the minus 15th cubic meters. And then there are more than 5,000 different types of molecule inside that cell, and many of those. And the number of copies ranges from several millions to one or two. But ultimately, there's some level of indivisibility to biological systems. That is, that they're either alive or they're dead. Right, that there's a, I mean, and it's, and it means it's hard to study them, because as you start to divide them, you know, once you get below the level of the cell, they die. There's evolution, which I'll come back to. There's some questionable things. Are there more different levels of organization in biological systems than there are in the physical world? And is there more mixing of things between different scales? And I guess that's the sort of thing I'd be interested in hearing from you folk about. And since I pulled overheads from different talks, here are some more biology as different things. So this is, and I guess one of the points about this is if you, it's very hard in biology to define things. That as you try and write a definition for things, you keep encountering exceptions to the rule. So that, for example, if you ask me to define the cell division cycle, I can give you a hand-waving description which is correct for most cells, but it doesn't cover all cells. And if you try and make it cover all cells, you can probably eventually write a paragraph definition, but then the definition is so complicated as to almost be useless. And so these are all features of living systems, and they're clearly physical systems that have some of these properties. And you could probably, or possibly, if you looked hard enough, find a physical system that would, I guess, have all of them except this one. That one of the points, again, that's worth making, it's obvious but worth stating, is that you and every other living organism on this earth are a part of an unbroken 3.8 billion year long great chain of being. Okay? That there is a continuous string of ancestors that connects you to the origin of life. Okay. Right, I guess the difference is, but how many of the components within that hydrogen atom have been exchanged with other atoms since the Big Bang?
I'm not thinking your body contains a single atom that was present in the Big
Bang. Actually, I'm sure that's not true. That's absolutely not true, because most there will be bases of DNA that I inherited from my parents, right?
There's something about the large number that's wonderfully deceptive. I was thinking by an example, someone said there's a Caesar that stabbed, and he said a tube bridge that at that last expiration, if you didn't have plants replacing the carbon dioxide, it just kept the carbon dioxide distributed uniformly around the world, so it was perfectly homogeneous. And every time everyone in this room breathed in, they would breathe in at least one molecule of CO2 that was expired by Caesar. And that has to do with... and I think it's wonderful how these things... We don't seem to think about volume. The other end of that scale that I enjoy is in the cell. You say, all right, the pH is 7. How many hydrogen atoms is it? Hydrogen photons are there? You think about like half a dozen, and you suddenly ask yourself, what does pH mean if there are only 6 photons in the cell? And I think that's not thinking about the go on and off.
Okay. Impressive or not, there are some properties biological systems. The one thing I think that makes biology most different from everything else is the idea of function. So, outside religious belief, things in the physical world like the sun or the Milky Way or the top quark or whatever, they can't be said to have a function in a sense that we understand, that they weren't put there to do something. Whereas in biology, that's not true. And there's a very clear similarity to engineering. I mean, people make things for functions. I mean, the bits on your car, even the ones that are apparently useless, someone thought they were good for something. And so in biology, components have been selected to perform specific tasks which all ultimately promote survival or reproduction or both. And that leads us into evolution. And amongst... redundancy is probably part of function, where one of the functions is robustness, which we'll come back to a bit. Yeah, I think that's a good addition to the list. So one of the things that some of my friends who are physicists worry about is that the definition of evolution is tautologous. That evolution is the survival of the fittest. The fittest are those who survive, and if you have problems with that, and I think this actually is not a tautologous statement, but there are lots of people who think it is. Let me try saying it this way, which is that the phenotype of an organism, and the ultimate phenotype that counts is reproductive success, how many viable progeny you leave, is some function of the genotype of the organism, its environment, and some level of stochastic events, like who gets struck by lightning. That the progeny genotype is some function of the parental genotype, and the mutation frequency, and the mutation frequency is greater than zero. If you grant those things, and you can write little computer simulations that do this, you will get long-term directed changes in genotype and phenotype, which random reproduction of individuals, regardless of what their genotype was, would not produce. Okay, and what that means is that if you can create a situation with what I've just described, where bad mutations, the frequency of bad mutations, that is, ones that impair an organism's capacity to survive, is greater than the frequency of good mutations, and the magnitude of individual bad mutations is bigger than the magnitude of the good ones, and you can start out with some level of reproductive success over here, and this is number of generations here. And if you select the organisms which have the best score of some parameter to reproduce, that score will go up over time despite these conditions, and if you just select them randomly from the population, it will do this. And you can do a lot of trials, and the two trajectories, I mean, there's a lot of bumping around, obviously, always look like this. And that's the thing that makes evolution different. And one of the things that biologists, it's hard to convince biologists of, is that evolution is about predicting the future. And in biology, that's regarded as a very, very bad thing to say, because there's something you're not allowed to invoke what's called anticipatory evolution, where you say, well, this is going to be fitter in the future, therefore this guy should reproduce better, because selection doesn't work that way. But you can look at things post hoc, so that if some organism had mutations that made it more likely to survive when the temperature of the planet increases by 15 degrees, if that event happens, they'll be the individuals who survive. And in that sense, there are two aspects that are selected for, presumably, in evolution. One is predictions about future conditions. And the other is that it's both about making the prediction, and it's about gambling. It's about what you do with the information and what difference strategies are. It's a lot like playing poker. Right. I mean, this is a very long game. The rules are very rigid, and there are a lot of people playing. Well, maybe that's a point we should come back to and talk more about. So this all goes under the name of, I mean, what evolution is doing is it's exploring some parameter space, and according to some set of criteria, it's selecting certain solutions and then propagating them, and we'll come back to that, because I think that's a general principle in a general scale invariant principle in biology. And evolution implies certain constraints. One of the strong constraints is a historical one, that everyone's descended from a common ancestor. So there are certain things that got fixed very early on and are probably extremely difficult to change. That recycling appears to be greatly preferred to invention. And the other point, and again this is probably belaboring the obvious, that probable solutions are strongly preferred. If you're exploring and there are certain solutions that are easy to find, those solutions will be found first, right, if you're exploring in even a partially randomized manner. And the other constraint, which is one that I'm particularly interested in and especially interested in talking to people here about, is the issue of robustness and evolvability. So let me define those terms for you. Robustness means that a particular biological system, and I'll come back in a second to what I mean by system or module or network, has certain properties that are quantitatively or qualitatively, since most biological measurements are qualitative, but this is also can be true quantitatively, that are remarkably robust to perturbations in either the external environment or the genes of the cell. And there's been very beautiful work by Stan Leibler's group looking at this in bacterial chemotaxis, where the precision of adaptation to a stimulus is tremendously robust in the face of very big quantitative fluctuations in parameters of the proteins that produce that property. Evolvability means that you can take some network and over prolonged selection and geological time, although actually you can do evolution in graduate student lifetimes in the laboratory, you can change the parameters of systems. And one of the things is that at first sight these two properties appear contradictory, yet I will make the argument that surviving biological systems, they had to have had this property in the past, and most of them have this property in the present. And one of the interesting questions is, does that enormously restrict the number of sort of engineering possibilities that you could have used for a given function, because very few of those would be both robust in the short term and evolvable in the long term. And it seems like that's an interesting question for theoreticians and modelers. If, for example, you said, let's take all the ways I can design a toggle switch between two conditions, and then was able to model how those switches could evolve, or how those different designs could evolve. How many of the designs are robust, how many of them are evolvable, and how many are both? One possibility is a remarkably small subset are both, in which case evolution in a sense is more predetermined than we might like to think. And again, that's a point I'll come back to. So this is what I said I can't talk about what I meant by systems or networks or modules, and biologists haven't yet really managed to come up with a good term. Lee Hartwell, John Hopfield, and Stan Leibler and I wrote a piece where we argued that a good word was functional module, and I'm still not sure that that's the best word. But what I mean by a module is a network of molecules that includes both nucleic acids, proteins, often small organic molecules, that performs a specific function inside the cell, and that's why I belabored the idea of function. An example is the ribosome and the proteins that associate with the ribosome to do protein synthesis. Signal transduction modules, which I'll talk in and give you concrete examples of later in the week. And the machinery that segregates the chromosomes when cell divides. And I believe it's true, and there is now some evidence that supports this, that there is a much denser set of connections within modules than there is between modules. And again, this is something that probably be interesting to talk more about. Yeah. Again, that comes back to this awkward issue of how do you define anything in biology. I can give you the sort of the hand waving thing where you say, is this a module? And I go, yes, according to my sort of elaborate internal definition, yes. Within something like protein synthesis, you could say that there are different, you know, there are submodules, for example, the amino acyl tRNA synthetases, which put the amino acids on the transfer RNAs and aren't physically associated with the ribosome. Maybe they're submodules. The ribosome's a submodule, and the whole thing together is a module that does protein synthesis. And then you start getting into issues of, well, how is protein synthesis controlled in regard to levels of amino acids inside the cell? And is that part of the same module, and is the machinery that controls the level of amino acids inside the cell in relationship to what's outside the cell, is that all part of the same module too? So again, I think it's one of these fuzzy definitions that it's hard to rigorously say exactly where the boundaries between molecules break down. The counter-argument to that is sometimes it's pretty clear. Individual ribosomal proteins are clearly part of some larger functional organization, right? That lots of them actually don't do anything except sit there and maintain the structure of the ribosome.
The right way to describe that would be, if exceptions can be made, they will be made, and the review takes care of it. That will keep any definition.
Yeah. I mean, there may be a deep reason why it's hard to make exact definitions in biology, which is that evolution tends to reward the exceptions to the rule. That is, resources are always limited. If you find some clever new way of doing things, that appears to break the, you know, is different from the way other people do it, you're liable to get resources that are otherwise prohibited, and therefore for that exception is rewarded. So the central question is, if you knew the DNA sequence and the initial conditions, both inside and outside a cell, and so that means the levels of all the proteins, where they are in the cell, their state of modification, can you from that predict the structure, behavior, and evolution of protein cells through all these different scale levels? And there are two approaches to that problem. And the tendency in the past for biologists has been to look in great detail at individual networks or modules. And the advantage of that is there have been tremendous successes doing that. So that Potashny talked to you about, all the years and years and years of effort that went into figuring out how bacteriophage lambda worked, and in the end, a lot got figured out. And they're clearly, from that sort of work and the work that Chacob and Monod did, there are general principles about how gene expression is regulated. So at least for some networks, that leads to solutions. Right. Now, whether they're the sort of solutions that a physicist would be happy with is not clear. So that Stan Leibler told me the story of when he was getting interested in bacterial chemotaxis, he asked biologists whether chemotaxis was well understood, and the biologist said, yes, I think so. And he said, well, who should I ask? Who's the best person to ask? And they said, Julius Adler. And so he was at some meeting, and he sat down with Adler for lunch. And he said, is bacterial chemotaxis really understood? And Adler said, well, yes, I think it is. And Stan said, well, okay, quantitatively, can you predict the following sorts of behavior? And Adler goes, oh, you mean understood at that level? No, of course not. And that's actually an important point about biology, is that a lot of it is understood on the sort of genetic networks drawing, where we think things work this way. We do experiments. It turns out that the experiments more or less conform with very qualitative predictions. But we can't, for example, explain things like the precision of adaptation, and we just quit worrying about it and go off and do something else. And to a physicist, that's a very unsatisfactory level of understanding. To get even to the level where biologists are happy requires an enormous investment, hundreds of a person years worth of work for an individual network. So that, I mean, in the case of bacteriophage lambda, it's probably thousands. And the second approach is to look at genome-wide analysis, which I'll talk more about, because that's part of the plea for help. And the pro of this is you can get data both in terms of money and in terms of people's efforts unbelievably cheaply compared to what we used to pay for it. And the question is the data worth anything? And we can only answer that question if in the affirmative if we can convert data into knowledge. Yes.
I don't see either of these approaches leading to vulnerability and
robustness. If you did this on experimental evolution, it might, which is what we're currently starting out to try and do, and I'll come back and talk a little bit at the end, although we're clearly going to run out of time. So there are two classes of answer to that problem, and one is, well, if we can solve the central question, how does all this work? There, in principle, there are two classes of answers. One is the devil's in the details. And what that means is we'll collect enormous amounts of data. We'll be able to make huge networks of supercomputers that by training on data sets associated with perturbations and making something like some enormous neural network, will be able to accurately, quantitatively and qualitatively, tell us how cells will predict how cells will behave in the face of a given perturbation. But we won't really understand how that works. And there are certainly people in biology who believe that this is true. That this is how it will turn out when the dust clears. And it will clearly be some good time before the dust clears. The alternative possibility, which I guess I believe mostly because I'm an optimist, is that general principles will be very important. The details obviously are going to be critical too, but we will be able to have some curiosity satisfying understanding of how biology works. And some of those are already clear. Charles Darwin and Alfred Wallace made the biggest contribution because they thought of the idea of evolution. And the argument that I would make is evolution is the lens through which we will understand biology. And I'll come back to that. One of the most important things that come out of evolution is that looking at what properties are conserved can be unbelievably informative. And I'll give you an example now, but I'll come back to this again. So the observation that Erwin Chargaff, who spent most of the rest of his life excoriating Watson and Crick, made, but which was absolutely critical to the solution of the structure of DNA, is he was a biochemist and he took DNA from different organisms and he chemically reduced it to its bases and he measured the relative abundance of each base. And what he saw was that whatever organism you looked at, although for an individual base it could vary between being as few as 10% of the bases is in an organism's DNA to as many as 90%. The following rule was always true, that the percentage of A's was equal to the percentage of T's and the percentage of G's was equal to the percentage of C's. And the critical deduction that Watson and Crick made from that was that A must base pair with T and G with C, at least in a double helical model for DNA. And that's, if you like, the first example, it's always dangerous to call things first, a very good example of how looking at the conservation of some property tells you something profound if you're smart enough to figure it out. There's modularity again. The robustness comes in part from that biology is very concerned about noise. That in a sense, one of the things that the biologists probably don't think nearly enough about is how noise resistance is important and how controlling it is important. So that if you want a system to be robust, it ought to be pretty resistant to noise, for example, genetic or environmental noise. On the other hand, you can do interesting things by making systems extraordinarily sensitive to noise. So there are lots of situations in biology which biologists talk about as symmetry breaking, and it's not clear that's such a great word. What they mean by that is you start out with some system which in some sense is isotropic, and something happens which makes it very, very anisotropic, and there's some self-propagating nature to that chain. And this is an example diagram here. So here you have two cells, and each cell can stimulate some property locally and inhibit it at long range. Okay, this is what biologists call lateral inhibition. And what that means is, if these two cells start out equivalent, but there's some stochastic fluctuation in the output from this pathway, which has a local stimulatory effect and a longer range inhibitory one of the cells will be a little more active, this one in this particular example, and it feeds back on itself, so it stimulates the positive output and the negative output. So this cell adopts one fate and this cell adopts another. And that's remarkably common in developmental biology. Coincidence detection is a big deal, and effectively biology has invented, as far as I know, all the same sorts of logical devices that computers have. And the last general principle is what many biologists call dependency, which is a way of linking two processes to each other, so that if, for example, you want to make sure that all the DNA in a cell is replicated before you try and segregate its chromosomes, which is a very good idea, because if you don't do that, you'll trash the chromosomes. And A here is unreplicated chromosomes, and B here is fully unreplicated or partially replicated chromosomes, and B is fully replicated chromosomes, and C is not having started to assemble a segregation machinery, and D is the fully assembled segregation machinery. If there's some part of the replication machinery that can actually monitor the extent of DNA replication, it can send, as long as it detects DNA that's in the process of replication, an inhibitory signal which stops spindle assembly from occurring. Okay? And so that's an example of dependency. Yeah, let me do one more overhead and then we'll, because that will finish it. So I just want to point out before we take a break, the demonstration that one of these principles occurs across an enormously wide range of scales, and that's exploration with selection, which you might argue is sort of the thing that biology has exploited the most and exploited again and again. So that, for example, in protein folding, there's this idea of kinetic funnels where proteins sort of explore some space and get sucked down some funnel that will direct them to the fully folded state. In the assembly of the mitotic spindle, the microtubules, so here's a pair of chromosomes. These white things are the kinetochores, the specialized region of the chromosome that's going to attach it to microtubules. And what the cell does is it literally fishes for the chromosomes because it sends microtubules out in random directions. They have a given half-life because of this property called dynamic instability, where they alternate between two states, either growing rapidly or shrinking. And so they get sent out, they shrink back. But if they capture or are captured by a kinetochore, they're stabilized. And so they explore space to find the chromosomes. And one of the things that Leibler's group showed was that the actual properties of this system appear to be perfectly matched to the task of finding the chromosomes as efficiently as possible. The same thing goes on in the nervous system, where during development, neurons grow out. The ones that hit important targets are protected from cell death. The ones that don't die, it's hopefully obvious to everyone that mate choice has something to do with exploration, with selection, habitat colonization, and ultimately evolution itself is exploration with selection. Okay, so the reductionist past. I think the idea in biology used to be that there were too many variables to deal with. And, I mean, that was clearly true. And there was a profound molecular ignorance about what was going on. And the number of perturbations you could create and the number of responses you could measure were very limited. And that led to this idea of isolating variables from each other as much as possible. Of doing phenomenological rather than molecular analysis. And in particular, to collecting minimal data. And I guess when I started thinking about it, I think it's not just true that it was hard to collect data, but that data was confusing. And that therefore people tried to collect the smallest amount of data that was required to address particular problems. And that sort of reductionist analysis led to formal properties like the idea of the gene, which existed and was very well elaborated long before it was either clear that DNA was the genetic material or what the structure of DNA was or how information was encoded in the sequence of the bases. And in general, what it meant is you started with local analysis and then tried to make global deductions from that local analysis. And I thought it might be worth.
Hold on. Yeah.
Yeah. Looks like it's late.
Yeah, it has. Okay.
So this is an example of analyzing things at a bunch of different levels. So this is what genetics does, and genetics is the branch of, again, I guess I shouldn't say the, it's one of the branches of biology that has most indulged in sort of logical analysis. And so first of all, the lowest level of analysis is the gene, and their genes are distributed on what initially were called linkage groups and later turned out to be chromosomes. So these are the concepts, all of which existed long before these things on this side could be measured. There are genetic interactions between genes, and these eventually lead to phenotypes. And so these genetic interactions include protein-protein and protein-nucleic acid interactions, and they ultimately, the phenotype is ultimately some form of system behavior. And it's this, I mean, we're pretty good now at going, at doing these parts of things. And we're fairly good at discovering genetic interactions, and the really big question is, how do you go from here to here? I just want to give one other example of phenomenological analysis, just because I think it's helpful. So this is a cell and interface. So this blue thing is the nucleus, and these green objects are microtubules. This is a cell in mitosis. The nucleus is broken down. The chromosomes have condensed. This is the mitotic spindle, which is going to segregate the chromosomes. This is a big change in the architecture of the cell. And you could try and understand that change, and in particular, it's a big change in the in both the dynamics and the distributions of the microtubules. You could try and explain that change by knowing every atomic level structural feature of the microtubules, everything about the chemistry, the proteins that interacted with them. We're enormously far from that stage, and it's not clear that it would be very easy to predict the properties of the system starting from the bottom and working up. And so instead, started by the work of Mitchison and Kirshner, what people did was a phenomenological analysis. And what they demonstrated is that microtubules have this property I referred to before of dynamic instability, where they get started by nucleation. They grow at some certain rate. They shrink at some certain rate. Their transitions between those two states, which are referred to as catastrophe and rescue, and that in principle, if you measure these parameters, the nucleation frequency, the growth rate, the shrinkage rate, the catastrophe frequency, and the rescue frequency, you ought to be able to predict the properties of the system. And in fact, people have done that and shown that the two big changes between mitosis and interphase are that the nucleation rate goes up a lot and the catastrophe frequency goes up a lot, which means you have more shorter microtubules. And their asymmetry is explained by the fact that there are local factors, like the ability of the kinetochores to stabilize the microtubules against catastrophe, that give you this asymmetric distribution of the microtubules in the cell. And that's actually been, the phenomenological analysis there has been tremendously successful, and it's very hard to see how you would have built from the bottom up. And I raise that point because of where we're about to go, which is systems level or sort of genome-wide descriptions, which are more or less, I think, predicated on the idea that you can build from the bottom up. And so here's the comprehensive present. We have the sequences of complete genomes. And then we have a variety of tools derived more and less directly from the sequence, and so we can measure mRNA abundance, which is what microarray analysis, the stuff that Joe DeRisi taught you about. In principle, we could probably develop tools to measure protein abundance. There are ways of identifying which proteins bind to which other proteins, of localizing proteins, of determining the chemical modification of proteins, things like phosphorylation and methylation, and ultimately protein activity. And the thickness of the red bar is supposed to indicate how feasible things are. So this is feasible, this is starting to be feasible, the order of these two should have been reversed in terms of their feasibility. doing this globally, and this is going to be remarkably hard for all the proteins in a population of cells at a given time. And the other thing I should point out, those are measurement tools. There are also sequence-derived perturbations, so you can make collections of mutations where you've mutated all the genes in an organism's DNA. And did Joe talk to you at all about using pools of strains which have been genetically marked so that you could simultaneously experiment on lots of mutants? If he didn't, that's true, and if people are interested, I could explain technically how that's done. And so the idea is that you're going to get comprehensive systematic data collection, and then somehow you're going to go from this global information to local understanding about how things work locally. And Joe explained all of this, presumably. So let's skip that. So I want to give you just a feeling for the magnitude of the problem. So here's the budding yeast, the organism that is probably the most genetically and genomically sophisticated of all organisms, not just of eukaryotes, but probably now both eukaryotes and prokaryotes. It has about 12 million base pairs of DNA. That encodes the information for 6,000 different messenger RNA species, whose abundance ranges from about 50,000 per cell. Oh, there are about 50,000 individual messenger RNA molecules per cell. For a given type of messenger RNA, the abundance varies between about 1,000 and a single molecule of a given species. And again, it comes back to the issues that you were worried about before, about what does it mean to have one molecule of something in a cell, because that implies stochastic fluctuations. The RNAs are encoded into proteins. There are about 20 million protein molecules in a cell. Again, there's an enormous variation in the abundance between different species. Not all genes are transcribed into RNA in any given cell type, and the same is true for proteins. If we think of the different states of proteins, and state as including things like where the protein is in the cell, which other molecules it's binding to, what chemical modifications are on that protein, they're probably on average, and this is a very rough and actually probably conservative estimate, about 10 different states for each protein. So you multiply 10 by 6,000, you get 60,000 different protein states. And then the question is, well, that's a lot of information. There are two questions. Can you collect all that information? If you can you make sense of it? I don't think that's true. So when I said at the beginning was that changes at this level and changes in the abundance of proteins can, you know, lots can happen without those. But in terms of these changes in state of covalent modification, the conformation of proteins and which things they're bound to, there are enormous number of changes. I guess the point that I was trying to make is that all these changes are invisible to things that only measure the abundance of messenger RNAs and the abundance of protein molecules. If the measurements of abundance don't distinguish between the different states, okay? But to get between interphase and mitosis, there are at least hundreds and possibly thousands of proteins that are changing their state. Okay? As in changing one of these things that are probably off the bottom of the screen for you. Their modification, their conformation, which other molecules they're bound to. Does that make sense? Yeah?
In what way they can affect phosphorylation?
Yeah, they're changing phosphorylation. There's very complicated recursion between things, so that the proteins, because their phosphorylation changes, which other proteins they're bound to can change, because it can change their chemical affinity for some other protein. Conversely, which other protein you're bound to can affect the probability that some protein kinase phosphorylates you. Okay?
How do you know that sounds?
Because we know by doing genetics and cell biology and identifying proteins. I mean, there are two possibilities. You can make mutations that screw something up in mitosis, right? And you can identify the proteins, and when you do that, the list starts getting very long, okay? Conversely, for some protein that you've identified, you can just look at the chemical modification state of that protein and compare cells in interphase and cells in mitosis, and there are lots and lots and lots of proteins where people have done that experiment, and the modification state changes, right? And at least some of the time, both types of information converge. That is, we know the protein has some important function in mitosis. We know its modification state changes, and people have actually done experiments that say that it's the change in modification that is driving the change in behavior, or vice versa. Okay? I could give you specific examples if I was giving the lecture, I guess, in the sense maybe you guys were expecting about the cell cycle. I mean, I could, in great and gory detail, describe what we know about how, you know, what things change between interphase and mitosis. There's a lot of data. And this has to do with a plea for help. So it's conceivably possible that one could do microarray analysis on each individual mutation which is viable. So of the 6,250 genes in yeast, about 5,000 of those genes can be removed without killing cells. That doesn't mean they don't do anything. It just means that the cells will still grow and proliferate under standard laboratory conditions. And so you could do microarray analysis on each one of those strains, and in principle, in each of those experiments, you look at all the genes, and so you get about 30 million data points from that experiment. Now, there's actually an interesting question about whether that experiment will ever get done, because biologists aren't particularly good at getting together and collaborating to do big experiments. And actually, one of the things that I worry a little bit about is that not enough sort of industrial scale science is going to get done. Genome sequencing, which clearly had to be done on an industrial scale, is continuing, but this sort of analysis based on the sequences, it's not clear if anyone's going to do this experiment. Yes?
I'd like to just have a question about the experimental feasibility, about where we are and things like that, in terms of moving down that list.
Mm-hmm.
Now that you have things like 2D gels and MassMac and all these types of things, are we at the point of being able to start to look at all the various different states of proteins, or is this something that is I think has a few years, or are there conceptual or practical limits to this?
Right now, there are detection limits. And so there are technical limitations. And it's also true that, it's probably true that for lots of the molecules, some very small fraction of them can be modified, and that's important. So again, it gets into, I don't think they're conceptual questions, they're technical questions. And one of the big questions is, the people who promote mass spectrometry argue there are real fundamental technical limitations to two-dimensional gels. Measuring protein abundance by mass spectrometry is a very expensive way of doing business, and one of the questions is, will there be cheaper, technically more feasible ways of doing things? And those they can be conceived of, but they haven't really been technically reduced to practice. So what might we try and get out of that sort of comprehensive data? So one is for particular modules to make parts lists. And one of the things, one of the ways you can do that, which actually works surprisingly well, and it's perhaps obvious in retrospect, but I don't think people would have anticipated it beforehand, that hierarchical clustering of transcript array data reveals that proteins that go up and down together have a very high probability of being involved in the same function. And presume, did Joe talk about that? Yeah. Okay. Another way of doing that comes back to the idea that I mentioned at the beginning, which is the conservation of things over evolution. So this is analysis due to Marcotte and Eisenberg at UCLA. And so what they argued is, if you've sequenced lots of genomes and you search for proteins by homology, sometimes you can find proteins and sometimes you can't. And so you can make it just a digital string where these are 4 proteins, these are 9 organisms, and when the protein's present, you write 1, and when it's absent, you write 0. And you see patterns, like the 2 red proteins, if one of them there, the other one is always there. And the same is true for the green guys. And what they showed by doing this sort of analysis is that proteins that appear and disappear during evolution have a very strong probability of being involved in the same function. A different way of looking at parts list is to look at what's called synthetic lethality. So here are 2 genes, A and B, that are involved in a process. A plus means the gene's alive, A minus means it's dead. You can having mutations in B and having mutations in A, neither one of those things in isolation kills cells. If you cross these mutants together and you generate progeny that are mutant in both genes, they're dead. And again, one of the things that is surprising, and it's one of the arguments, it's I think perhaps the strongest experimental argument that connections within modules are dense and between them they're sparse, is that when you look at this analysis, and so you can go out and having mutations in gene B, you can go out and globally find all the genes that have the property of gene A here, that is, that you can combine mutations in A and B and produce synthetic lethality by doing that. But the vast majority of synthetic lethal interactions are between mutations in genes that function in the same module. Okay. So that can identify the list of parts. Then you want to try and know which parts touch each other. So this is with the analogy of an electrical circuit, this is trying to figure out the connectivity of the circuit. And there are direct physical methods of doing that, which aren't so far well suited for genome-wide analysis. They're surrogate physical methods, like the 2 hybrid method of detection. Again, something I can explain if people. And there's evolutionary covariation. I'll come back to that too. And that's an idea rather than something that's been shown to work. There are the properties of the individual components of the circuit, what in an electrical circuit would be the device properties. There are 2 parts of that. There's protein structure, and there are 2 different ways of getting that. There's experimental and there's prediction, and you will hear a lot about structural genomics. What structural genomics aims to do is to determine the structure of one exemplar of each domain that goes to make up proteins. And then with that information to predict the structure of all other related domains. That doesn't mean predicting the structure of entire proteins, which will still be mysterious. And the other approach is protein structure prediction. Again, I'll come back to that in a second. And that's something I'd actually be particularly interested in talking to people here who are interested in structure prediction. And then there's the function of proteins. And it can be measured qualitatively by a very simple measure of, and again, this is another example of using evolutionary conservation. If your protein is homologous in sequence to some protein that does something and has a well-characterized function, there is a very good chance that that's what your uncharacterized protein does. To get quantitative information about what proteins do in a functional sense is extremely hard. And again, it's not, that's a conceptual issue in terms of doing things systematically, that it's not conceptually clear how you would do that. And that obviously leads into questions. If all the information you have is going to be qualitative, how well are you going to be able to understand anything? Then there's a question of how do you understand how module structure leads to function, and experiments and computations lead to predictions. And again, a big issue, and one that would be interesting to talk to all of you about, is to what extent will computation and modeling, can it replace experiments here? And then, having predictions, you want to do perturbations, measure responses, and that constitute tests of your ideas about how module structure leads to function. And so there is both room for optimism and pessimism about how easy that will be to do. So optimism comes from the case of bacterial chemotaxis. This is the world's most simplistic drawing of what the bacterial chemotaxis regulation system does. The green triangle is a ligand. It interacts with the receptor. The arrow means the receptor has a positive output. It does two things. It affects the swimming behavior of the bacteria, and it also feeds back and inhibits this response. Okay? And because of that feature, what this circuit does, and like I said, this is a very gross oversimplification, it acts as a detector for rate of change. So it detects rate of change of a ligand over time. And this system is well worked out, both qualitatively and quantitatively, and I think we could really begin to say that this is understood. Here's grounds for pessimism. So the somatic gastric ganglion in the lobster is something that controls the behavior of the lobster stomach and how it squishes food about. It's composed of about 30 nerve cells. The properties of those individual nerve cells are known. The connections amongst them are known. And yet, despite that information, there are not satisfying predictions of how that collection of cells generates the rhythm of these processes. So here are the global questions. So one is about how connected to and how insulated from each other modules are. And I guess one of the points that I'll make in passing is when we talk about evolution, we tend to think very strongly of things that are selected for, right? You know, that one protein modifies another protein as part of a signal transduction pathway. I think we have a very widespread tendency to ignore the things that are selected against. The fact is that that protein modifies its partner in the same signal transduction pathway and not some related protein in some other signal transduction pathway. And that's what I mean by insulation, that insulation is probably at least as important as connectivity. And that means that certain connections have been very strongly selected against. One of the questions that worries me a lot is how do you make adaptive responses to novel stimuli? So you think of yourself as having five senses, but that's only because there are five senses that register you to you consciously. Your body monitors blood pressure, blood osmolarity, blood pH, blood oxygen tension, and a whole host of other things. Even something apparently simple like a budding yeast cell probably has something like 20 different sensory modalities. And the question is, if let's say we make the assumption that no more than six of those are being significantly talked to by the environment at any given time, there are about 60,000 different possible combinations of responses. It's remarkably unlikely that evolution has had the time for a given genotype, or a given sort of distribution of genotypes, to test out all 60,000 of those combinations. And yet, there is some reasonable chance in the future that you're going to encounter combinations that haven't previously been road tested. And so one of the questions is, how do cells process information in a way that maximizes the possibility that when they encounter a novel combination of stimuli, they do something adaptive rather than something maladaptive. And I guess I think that's a sort of profound question in biology, and one that we don't really, I don't think we've thought about really, and we haven't had a chance to measure things comprehensively. Now I think one could start to think about experiments one could do to ask questions about this. And the other thing, which I guess, you know, if you were thinking very anthropomorphically, we could come back to things about mate choices, about how you do safe state changes. Which is, here are two states, A and B, that where many of the parameters inside the cell differ between A and B. So, I mean, if we say that the biology is defined by 60,000 protein states, which is a simplification, but it's already complicated enough to make it an acceptable simulation, it means that where a cell is can be plotted in some 60,000 dimensional space, right? That defines some state of a cell. And so here's state A and state B, and it's easy to imagine there are certainly measured states that differ from each other in thousands or even tens of thousands of those parameters. And it's presumably true that in that 60,000 dimensional space between, you know, that many of the points in that space are disallowed in the sense that if cells get there, they're dead. And so how do cells make safe transitions between these very different states? And again, that's something that I guess what I think is interesting is one could have stated that question long before genomics, right? I mean, it's not that genomics made that question askable, but now we can collect the data in the sense that we can monitor lots of these states as cells go from one process to another. It's because it's experimentally tractable, it tends to make us think more about, is it worth thinking about? So I thought I'd just give you two examples to finish with of of things that we're thinking about doing. One of them's theoretical and the other one's experimental. So one of them's exploiting further this idea of how covariation can lead to prediction. And so for DNA molecules, prediction is incredibly simple. You have the sequence of one strand, you can predict the sequence of the other, right? Because of base pairing. For RNA molecules, there are two sorts of structure. There's secondary structure and tertiary structure. Tertiary structure is where all the atoms are in space. Secondary structure is which parts of an RNA molecule, for example, like this helix here, are base paired to each other. And the way that that's been deduced is by phylogenetic analysis of sequences. So what you do is you take, and it's been most famously done with ribosomal RNA, you sequence ribosomal RNA from a vast zoo of different organisms. You then create a phylogeny of the evolutionary relationship of those sequences to each other. And for two positions, and I've just drawn it for two positions, but you do all pairwise comparisons. You say, okay, map the sequence in individual organisms onto the phylogeny. And then what you look for is pairs of positions that have the relationship that's drawn in this diagram here, where if there's a T in this organism at position one, or blue position, there's an A in the black position, and vice versa, and where there's a G, there's a C. In other words, it's always true that these two positions are correlated with each other. And so again, that's exploiting the Watson-Crick base pairing scheme. And that proved to be a remarkably effective way of predicting which parts of the ribosomal RNA sequences were base paired to which other parts, and it's been true for many other RNA sequences as well. So the question is, can we use anything like that for proteins? And the obvious answer is no, because there isn't some simple rule for when one amino acid contacts another one, there's no equivalent of the base pairing scheme. It's not like leucine base pairs with valine and phenylalanine with alanine or anything like that. It may be possible to generate statistical predictions that there's a tendency to switch one pair to another, and you can help with probability. But what is still true, if you get rid of the base pairing information, well, I can't really do it quite the way I want. If you get rid of the base pairing information, you can still deduce that in this tree there was a change at this node, and in this tree there was a change at this node. And the same is true for this tree here. And so one of the questions is, using that reduced amount of information, could you still successfully predict base pairing RNA? That is, you're just looking at when changes are correlated. You're not worried about what's changing to what. You're just mapping the positions of the changes, and you're looking for the pairs that have most similar positions of the changes. So if that were true for RNA structures, then in principle, maybe that should be true for protein structures. And so a very bright graduate student got talked into this idea by me and is actually trying to test it for some known protein structures where lots of exemplars have been sequenced, to ask, at least for some fraction of the contacts within a protein, can we predict them from looking at evolutionary covariation? Because if one could do that, it would mean that attempts to predict protein structure, whether they're ab initio attempts or whether they're homology-based attempts, would start out with a certain number of the contacts already defined, and so the amount of space that would have to be spaced would have to be searched would go down dramatically. And the second part of this idea is, if there's any truth in it at all, which remains to be seen, these, instead of being amino acid positions within the same protein, black could be one protein and blue could be amino acid in another protein. So in principle, if there's any merit to this idea, you ought to be able to computationally predict which proteins interact with each other because they have conserved covariation of amino acids in the parts of the protein that contact each other. So the last thing I want to talk about is doing experimental work on how things evolve, and obviously one of the most exciting things is the idea that experimental and theoretical work could be coupled and could influence each other. So there's internetwork evolution, network evolution, protein evolution. There's questions of theory versus experiment. One of the questions I'm particularly interested in is, how predictable is evolution? So what we're told, and what we all, or biologists, learned at their grandparents' knees, whoever their biological instruction grandparents were, is that evolution is unpredictable because it works on chance mutations. And one of the questions is that locally true? Given that the probable solutions will be the ones that are picked, if you apply some particular sort of selective pressure and you do it multiple times in parallel, are the solutions radically different, or are they in fact surprisingly the same? And so we're interested in trying to experimentally test that idea. And doing experimental evolution should tell us something about robustness versus evolvability. And what I was just talking about gets back to Monod's famous thing about chance and necessity. And the last, I mean, before I talk about two specific experiments, evolution may also be a better way of addressing how networks work than what genetics does, because what genetics does is you screen for broken networks, find the changes, and try and do further analysis to figure out how the network works. And actually, if you were telling this to a smart 8-year-old, they might not believe that this is the best way of doing it. Evolution, instead of breaking networks, bends them. And it may, therefore, by finding the changes in those bent networks, be much easier to say things about how the networks work. Well, by selecting for an altered function.
Yeah,
and I'll give you, let me give you an example. Now, and so yeast is a very good organism for doing experiments like this. And so here's an example of an experiment that we're trying to do. So if you treat cells with mating factor, so yeast cells, the two sexes talk to each other by pheromones. And those pheromones induce the expression of genes involved in mating. If you damage the DNA of cells, you induce a set of genes involved in DNA repair. And the question is, if, and there's a lot of if and fiddling involved here, if you genetically engineer cells so that you can select for the expression of these genes, which there are ways of doing, and now you do reproduction with mutation and selection, can you select for situations where DNA damage, as well as inducing the repair genes, is also inducing genes involved in mating? Okay, so if you like, this is burning the insulation off the wire. And one of the interesting questions is, if you do that multiple times, is a place where the insulation is burnt off the same in every experiment? And since there are lots of other signal transduction pathways in the cell, is this cross, this cross communication now restricted to this pair of pathways, or is it also starting to occur with lots of the other pathways? And so these experiments are in their infancy, but that's what we're trying to do. Sure. The bit about burning off the insulation, or just what the experiment is. The question is, here are two pathways that are insulated from each other. That is, when you expose cells to pheromones, you don't induce these genes. When you damage cells' DNA, you don't induce these genes. I should say, as far as we know, I don't know that anyone's ever done the experiment really carefully, but we'll certainly do that to start. So what we want to do is ask, can you select, if you allow cells to mutate their DNA, and you select for cells where these genes are expressed when this stimulus is given, can we find this situation? Okay? Where this stimulus now induces both sets of genes. Okay? Right, we hope that it will be able to happen. And what we probably do is, what we start out by doing is we give them a very low level of mating factor where we get some response out of these genes, and we now select for mutants where doing this at the same time gives more response. So I think that the technical challenge in these experiments is to get the first step, right? Because you're right, you're hoping that something will happen. But if you can get the first step, it's probably easy then to get subsequent mutations that make this cross communication stronger and stronger.
Can you explain why that particular pair of responses?
Because it's we have the tools to do the experiment. I mean, it's basically a historical accident of the development of biology that there are good sets of tools for both of these pathways. So there's no deep biological reason for picking these two responses.
I mean, not seeing that the DNA damage is more immediately to respond to DNA damage than to any other
thing. Yeah, cells respond pretty immediately to mating pheromones.
They're not going to die if they don't.
I think you could argue it. I mean, if they have some mutation that's going to kill them in 10 minutes because the conditions are going to change and they have to mate to someone else to survive, then mating's pretty important for survival. These are actually, I would have picked this condition. I would have picked something different for this, but the postdoc who's doing the experiments picked this one, and it's his world, not mine.
Morphologies are the
these pathways are, they're homologous in the sense that they both involve protein kinases, and you know protein kinases come from a single origin. Otherwise, they're not. And we could have chosen. There are much more homologous pathways. Yeah, the pathway that induces pseudohyphal growth would be a lot closer. And so one of the questions is, should you do the easy step first? And again, that's something where we've had some discussion and amicable disagreement about. Okay? So since it's noon, that's probably a good place to stop.